Hello and welcome to Eggpod Express with me, Chris Shaw. Eggpod Express takes a jaunty stroll through 1960s music magazines with a potpourri of delicious guests. To read along with us, the magazine's online at iamtheeggpod.com, where you'll also find an exclusive playlist related to this particular issue. To support this podcast and to access bonus content, please subscribe to patreon.com/eggpod. And this is part two of my interview with Andrew Milton. Enjoy.
Kathy McGowan, of Ready Steady Go fame, has designed her first collection for this show. This attractive TV star is a girl of many talents. The next creation was displayed by Kathy McGowan herself. A tattersall check woolen shirt dress.
Page 24 to 38, we have a huge section. It's the night of the year, and I want to share it, says Kathy McGowan. Lights of all colours, soft and shaded. The background sound of the Beach Boys singing Wendy. The Beatles nattering away either side of me, and the Stones creased up with laughter a few feet away. Cliff talking earnestly to Sandy Shaw. Billy Walker heading for the dance floor with Dusty Springfield. Connor asking Sean Connery rapid-fire questions about James Bond. I had better come clean. I have started to romanticise Kathy's dream party. And this is basically lots and lots of pages about not a lot, really, isn't it?
Yeah, this is pure rave. You know, this is the pure unfiltered rave. You know, it's like fashion, fantasy, fiction, and light padded around light celebrity anecdotes. That's all it is.
Yeah,
it's the essence of the magazine. So this is probably what it does best, I suppose.
Mm.
Yeah, Kathy McGowan. Yeah, the closest thing 1964 had to an influencer.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. She was the Ready Steady Go made her the youth culture ambassador. But she's still around, isn't she? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I've actually invited her to come on this. I don't know if she'll be up for it or not, but I'd love to do that.
Yeah, she doesn't get involved much in nostalgia stuff, I don't think. I've watched lots of documentaries over the years and she hasn't been in any of them. But lots of great stories. Anyway, Kathy McGowan, whether she's waiting for everyone to pass away before she tells them, I don't know. But she should write a book, or should write about them anytime, just for people like us who want to know all this gossip and all these little bits and pieces of how everything worked.
But there's a lot of, again, we were talking about product placement in here. There's a little thing on here. Mix and match these clothes for your come cozy dream of a party. And it reads, you think it's an editorial, but it's basically an advert.
For this a bungle coat or whatever it's called from C&A.
Yeah.
£12, 1 shilling and sixpence, which was £340 today. £300 for a coat. You know, I guess people would buy it at HP back then, but that's a lot of money for a big fluffy coat with four buttons. But, you know, you can imagine if you had it, what your friends would think, you know?
I would pay that to look like bungle. I really would. Cumberland Tech Streets. Make a spectacular entrance to any party, dream or real. All you need is bags of self-confidence and this sizzling, phony polar bear coat. It's head-turning and gasp-letching. Ugh. And you'll know how bears feel. It will keep you warm and snug too. From C&A. Yeah, £12.
C&A, £12. Yeah, well, C&A, that's probably the most expensive thing they've ever sold.
But I wonder, when it's this phony polar bear coat, surely you couldn't get real polar bear coats back then, could you? Please tell me no.
No, I'm sure not. They were just making the point that it was phony polar bear coat, you know, otherwise it'd be more expensive.
Yeah. How could something so cruel be so comfy?
But you would accept that. And these days you'd go, oh, well, that's a sort of like a plant or something. But back then all this was new. So people accepted it and that's where it was. And that's how it worked. You know, people, this was early days of this type of marketing, and, you know, record companies and companies really, really hooked onto it, like they do now, I suppose, with influencers on Instagram and stuff and this type of thing. They still do the same stuff today. And people are a bit more suspicious and a bit more wary these days of that sort of thing. But I guess back then it was all new and, you know, these people really did wear these things and having a great time.
Yes.
Sort of
stuff. Yeah.
Brothers and sisters, it's a wildest song making turn. If you want to have some soul, if you want to be a witness, I want you to listen while I testify. Maybe I can help you to get some souls and be a witness, baby. You want to be a witness? All it takes is the rhythm in your feet. Don't worry about the music, baby. You gotta have a beat. Now you got some
there's a bit on page 34 as part of this huge thing. I found it quite interesting. It's just insights into what the Groovy Kids were listening to. So it's just interesting to see, you know, Kathy McGowan knew what was going on. So what was going on in December 64? She says, it's not good enough to keep an eye on the charts to know what music's in fashion for your party. You've got to be able to forecast the big trends in sounds and also rake up some of the old ones as well. Right now, fashionable music covers a wild field, from blue beat dances to smooch, from jiving and shaking to the bird and the Mick. That's a dance with jerky hand movements named after Mick Jagger. People my age still do that, I have to say. Right now, the in discs to play are Any in the Charts, Any by the Isley Brothers, Didn't They Rock Up a Storm on Ready Steady Go, all Roy Orbison's past hits, music by Johnny and the Hurricanes, who were really big 4 years ago. That surprised me. And Any records by Marvin Gaye and any other Tamla Motown artists. And of course, Mary Wells and the Supremes.
Yeah, it's a reminder that the teens weren't just listening to the pop charts. They were sort of digging a bit deeper and stuff, like Beatles were and stuff. You know, looking behind the chart at the time. There was so much great music around at that time. It must have been an incredible, you know, the stuff coming from America, which people really didn't know about. I mean, British people, I think, knew more about American music than Americans knew about British music at that time. So all those things coming over, and the Beatles were always quoting, you know, their R&B influences and Marvin Gaye and everything in every radio show they did. So you can imagine the teenagers going to the shops. I heard about this Marvin Gaye chap, you know, what's all that about? And, you know, got one of his singles and things. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, you know, I'm sure this magazine was well up to speed on what was happening music-wise outside the charts too.
Yeah. On page 36, because throughout this whole article, there's various photos on here. There's a photo of Kathy McGowan with Manfred Mann and Paul Jones, and she's play-acting her imaginary party by a remember bowl of crisps. And Paul Jones is happily playing along. But Manfred is giving Kathy what can only be described as a death stare. It's a genuinely creepy photo, this.
They use some odd ones. There's the one in the middle of the Beatles, John Lennon's going like this, you know, sort of.
Yeah.
Like, really sort of doing a funny pose with his hand. And the next issue I have of this magazine, she makes this into like a club called the Clan, and it's Clan members. And these people would be Clan members, sort of members of her club, pop star friends who'd be members of a club. They're Clan members, like Dave Clark Five and Manfred Mann. And there would be the Clan. So yeah, very, very odd looking session, you know, just hold those crisps and just take a crisp pool. And, you know, it's like they're one
and
shot
Manfred
to do it.
Stare at Sandy like you want to kill her.
One shot to get it right. And that was the best. Yeah, that was the best one they had. Yeah, these photos in the late 80s when I worked for an auction house, we had a big box of transparencies, and there were all these 5x4-inch transparencies, color transparencies of these sessions in this box.
Wow.
And they went up for auction, and they were bought by magazines and individual people, and such great quality photographs and taken by the great photographers of the day. Terry O'Neill, Jean-Marie Perrier, who took the Beatles later on in 67 with the Strawberry Fields sleeve. They all cut their teeth, if you like, in this magazine. And that's why it was so important. And you know, these beautiful pictures and on this paper, you can imagine them on the walls of every teenager.
Oh, yeah.
PJ Proby, I'm not so sure, but definitely the Beatles and the other guys.
More of a voice later.
Anyone who ever loved, look at me and know that I love you. Anyone who ever dreamed could look at me and know I dream of you. Knowing I love you so, anyone who had a heart would take me in.
We turn to page 41. You're telling us. Brickbats or bouquets? We want your letters. For the best, there's 2 guineas, plus a special bonus prize of 2 guineas for the best letter from overseas. And this is the letters page. Any jump out at you?
Yeah, WF from Hammersmith says, what makes Sandy Shaw think we need another Dionne Warwick? Perfect example of 1960s British snark there. That was very, very good. I guess they sang the same sort of songs, but...
They were notoriously pinching them, weren't they? They were like Cilla Black as well. Like, Dion would release the record over in the States. They'd hear it, quickly knock up a UK version, and beat them to the punch.
Anyone who had a heart, you know, there's always something there to remind me. And I prefer the British versions, obviously. I don't know why. I definitely Sandy Shaw's one, I think. And but yeah, you know, Dion did some good ones, but I prefer the Silla's version of Anyone Who Had a Heart. And just the production, I think, not mainly because of the voice, but the production. I like the British production, the sound, and there's always something there to remind me. Has great production as well.
I think Dion's has a better key change because they're two slightly different ones. Mm. I'm going to play them for you now. You can compare yourselves and see who's wrong or right.
There's no wrong or right.
No.
Always be a part of me. Oh, whoa, 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 whoa. A part of me.
But yeah, they nicked all the good songs. Bacharach and David, you know, they went over there and the publishers would dole them out. And but again, as I said, British people probably weren't that aware of Dionne Warwick's version. It happens all the time. In the '80s, when I heard stuff like Bananarama doing this, "It Ain't What You Do, It's the Way You Do It" and stuff like that, I never knew it was a cover version. I didn't even know Soft Cell. You know, Tainted Love was the cover version.
Yes.
You know, so these things come round, you know, to every generation. So I guess people didn't know then either. But yeah, Sandy Shaw made some good stuff, actually. I think she's pretty underrated.
She did a great covers album in about 1968.
Reviewing the Situation.
Yes. And a version of Your Time Is Gonna Come by Led Zeppelin.
Yes. And Even Love Me Do.
Even Love Me Do, yes. Highly recommended, ladies and gents. Check it out. And it's really good covers, really bizarre song choices as well.
Yeah, I've got the original album. There's also a CD from the 90s on RPM, which sort of expanded it and was a really great Mama Roo, all the stuff she does on that was really fantastic covers album. Yeah, gotta get hold of that. And even the Puppet on a String album is actually quite good. It's got quite a lot of good sort of mid-60s songs on there that, what's his name, Chris Andrews, wrote and produced. Very talented chap.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've got a lot of time for sort of that sort of Sandy stuff.
We weren't allowed to listen to Sandy Shaw as a kid because my dad left for a woman who looked exactly like Sandy Shaw.
Hello.
So whenever she came up the radio, it kept turned off immediately, accompanied by some really offensive words.
No, it wasn't that extreme. My mother would tell me to turn things off that she never liked, like Gene Pitney or something. She's like, oh, Cliff Richard. She never listened to that. And it's like, don't come on with any Cliff Richard records, or don't come on with any Gene Pitney records. But no, it was never that extreme. Wow.
Fair play.
Yeah, exactly.
A Stones fan in Staffordshire writes, "I've just achieved the world's greatest triumph, persuading my dad that the Stones are the greatest group. He now prefers them even to the Bachelors, whom he greatly supports because he and Mum know the words of all their old songs. Last night, he even told my sister to be quiet while he listened to one of their records. We're still trying to recover."
I don't know how many parents are really into the Stones. I don't know, because it's the antithesis of the Bachelors, aren't they, really? Same label.
Yeah.
It's totally different.
It's quite a leap, isn't it? Gosh.
I could ride around the world in an old ox cart and never let another girl breathe in my heart.
Ain't that loving you, baby? one of the constant themes of this sort of time was, is Elvis slipping? You know, sort of like the idea that Elvis was finished, and which was of course perpetuated by the Beatles and stuff. So, but he was still churning out his movies and stuff. And the single he had in the charts on that week, "Ain't That Lovin' You Baby," backed with "Ask Me," was actually recorded in 1958. So it was a 50s song, but released in 64. And it's a really good song. You know, it's a great song. It's one, again, it's another one which my mother had when she was young. So I sort of grew up with that song. So I liked it anyway. But to find out it's from 64 and not from 58, recorded in 58, was quite a revelation.
Yeah. But there's a couple of letters about that on there in here.
Yeah. It was a constant theme about, you know, Elvis and things on Jukebox Jury. One of the first times John Lennon was on, he slagged Elvis's song off. When he was on there, you know, so it was, it became a constant theme in these magazines.
Yeah, well, Kathy writes, charming letter, Kathy Reynolds. Reader Janice Parsons says she'll eat her Elvis records if anyone thinks the Stones are good looking. I hope she swallows them whole and chokes herself. She'd ended it, kind regards.
Oh, shame.
And Shirley Chambers from Islington responds, Elvis slipping, definitely false. Since I became a fan in 1957, I can't remember how many times I've heard this. Each new singer that comes along is supposed to be heralding the downfall of Elvis. He's still here, but where will the Beatles and the Stones be in 7 years' time?
Ah, there you go. That's the question, isn't it? Yeah, I guess it's sort of people didn't see how things would change, how music would progress. You know, they thought they would be doing the same sort of thing all the time, you know, like they'd say in the 60s, we're not going to be singing She Loves You when we're 40 or whatever. But yeah, Nobody sort of factored in the progression of the music and the fashions and whatever. But yeah, no, Elvis did sort of come back to it in the end. Mm. My mother was a big Elvis fan as well, I think, of people of that early 60s generation, with the things that came out just before the Beatles, in between the Army and the Beatles, the 1960 stuff, which I think was very good, very well recorded. And but the 60s things, I can't get into 60s Elvis until it gets to 68, 69.
I have to admit, yeah, that's my favourite comeback specials, basically.
But the films were always on in the summer holidays, weren't they, on television?
They were, yes.
And they're like one every day, so we'd watch them and like, what is all this about?
So what was going in this week's UK albums chart? So here's the UK albums chart from the 6th of December 1964. At number one, got the Beatles with Hard Day's Night. And number two, the Rolling Stones. So the top two bands of the time.
Hard Day's Night, don't expect it to still be there at the end of December 64. It comes out in July 64 and you think, that's it. But these things hung around for weeks and years at the top of the charts. It was last week number one too. But hot on its heels on number four was Beatles for Sale, the new album, which had just come out. Again, didn't go in at number one. It was at number four behind the Bachelors. And they're back to the 60s. Again, charity shop favourites. If you're familiar with looking around charity shops, lots of Bachelors records.
Oh, yes. Always. Yeah.
And but, Stones at number two.
Yeah. I think it's something worth talking about, the comparing similar albums at the time. The prevalence of these R&B influences and Chuck Berry covers with various degrees of success. But the Rolling Stones were number two, the Kinks at number five, all with their debut albums, The Animals at seven, and then Five Faces of Manfred Mann at number 10. And they're all trying to do the similar things. So you've got Chuck Berry, they've all more or less covered Chuck Berry, the Rolling Stones did Carol. Beatles, as you said, just released Beatles for Sale, so they did rock and roll music.
Just let me hear some of that rock and roll music. Any old way you choose it. It's got a backbeat, you can't lose it. Any old time you use
Kinks,
it.
Beautiful Delilah.
Beautiful Delilah, sweet as apple pie. Always gets the second low, fellas pass by. Ever try to
Too Much Monkey Business.
Run to and fro, hard working at the mill, never fail. Let the million come around, baby.
that also appeared on the Yardbirds' current album, Five Live Yardbirds. The Animals did Memphis, Tennessee. Round and around.
Say the jump was rocking, going round and round. Oh, baby, with a crazy sound. And you never stop rocking.
And then it's the same with Bo Diddley, you know, the Rolling Stones did Mona.
Say, hey, Mona. Oh, Mona.
King's Cadillac.
I don't want no Cadillac.
Animal's Story of Bo Diddley.
Now let's hear the story of Bo Diddley. The rock and roll scene in general.
I'm a man. And, you know, it's Willie Dixon, Howlin' Wolf, Muddy Waters. They're all taken from the same source. So it's interesting to hear how the Beatles do it slightly differently, because they will also go for the girl groups. That's where they differ from all the other bands at the time, I think.
Yeah, this was a real crossover point between the end of Merseybeat and the beginning of the R&B thing, which sort of, and Beatles for Sale sat sort of in the middle of that. You know, I don't think there's any R&B on Beatles for Sale, but there's not much Merseybeat on it either. But yeah, you're right. The R&B albums, the Stones, the Kinks, the Animals, Manfred Mann, that was where it was going, and Merseybeat was like finished basically in 1965. There wasn't hardly anything coming out from those groups that made any successes either in the singles charts or the album charts. The Swinging Blue Jeans maybe carried on for a bit. Jerry and the Pacemakers didn't really in 65. They sort of went down, and yeah, the R&B was taken over, and that was the hot thing. That was the new thing.
Yeah. So the Rolling Stones, obviously produced by Andrew Lou Golden and Eric Easton, but there's some, yeah, Route 66. All that, it's basically anything you hear on the Beatles at the BBC or on these albums, I think.
Yeah.
But they also do a spoof of Can I Get a Witness? Called Now I've Got a Witness, yeah. Like Uncle Phil and Uncle Gene. And I look, obviously, under the credit, Nanka Felge, basically anything credited with Nanka Felge meant that the entire band got writing royalties, which was inspired by the Edith Grove flatmate Jimmy Felge. And Ananka was Brian Jones' name for, well, you stick your finger up each nostril and pull down your eyelids.
I've just seen you do that. You won't be able to see it. I've just seen you do that.
It's a great book by Roy Carr and Tony Tyler. You know, they did the Illustrated Beatles. They did one for the Stones as well. And I remember they'd have, here's Brian performing a half Ananka, if he only had one finger, and Keith doing the full Nanka.
Give it the full Nanka. The charts, I mean, there was, yeah, that strong R&B, but there was also the usual mix of MOR stuff that was still selling. As I said, albums were really expensive, and grown-ups bought a lot of albums. Two Jim Reeves albums in there, 12 Songs of Christmas and Gentleman Jim, and then you've got your Camelot, My Fair Lady, and Cliff's Wonderful Life, which is quite a good album, to be fair. Yeah, I'm quite fond of Wonderful Life. And Roy Orbison, twice, in Dreams and A Pretty Woman, two albums of his charts.
I mean, he was touring everywhere as well, wasn't he? And on the TV shows as well, he was very high in the public's consciousness.
One of the first songs I remember, which my father had, is In Dreams, and I remember listening to that when I was very young, you know, wondering what it was all about, but just hearing the voice, it was it. And when he goes again, remember, I was like, wow.
How's it go again?
And then you said goodbye. That bit was like, wow, it's otherworldly, and I was blown away by that. It's still one of my favourite songs.
They call me Shorty, 'cause I know what love is all about. They call me Long Toe
Kinks debut, Kinks. Because I've noticed, again, more Beautiful Delilah, the Chuck Berry cover. Dave Davis, because they share the vocals. It's strange Dave Davis does the first vocal on the first Kinks album. But he's got an unusual choice of vocals at this time. He's doing like a strangulated Jagger.
Yeah.
And it's... because he would have been a kid, really. And he sounds like a kid pretending to be a grown-up.
Exactly.
Pretending to impersonate Jagger. Yeah, quite a bizarre lesson. And there's one I do love. Because basically you've got the covers on here, which tend to be the R&B covers that Dave takes, but Ray does a few. But there's a few Ray Davis numbers on here. And there's one, So Mystifying, which is the second track on it. Mm-hmm. It's definitely inspired by the Rolling Stones. It's All Over Now. I think listening to it, especially with Dave's choice of vocals, I think the Ray Davis songs, his self-composed songs, are so much better than the covers, or so much more suited to the Kinks than the R&B covers.
Yeah, I'm glad they sort of ditched those and his songwriting came to the fore. That's much better, yeah.
But things like Cadillac as well, obviously Bo Diddley, everyone was covering as well. It's almost a drone. You know, he did on See My Friends, that kind of drone. It's like hearing Psychedelia in 1964.
Tired of Waiting, that sort of...
Yeah.
I had that down, yeah. No, great, great songs, yeah. I really look forward to digging into the Kinks with the videos. I did a couple of videos just covering two periods in the 60s, covering 64 to 67, then onwards. But I'm really going to get into the albums and in detail. So
yes, please.
Stay tuned. Bob Dylan in number 19.
Yes.
Another side of Bob Dylan. Not big, that it was dropping down the charts at that point.
Yeah, that's his final acoustic album, was it? Before being electric.
Yeah. And then we mentioned the MOR ones, Camelot, My Fair Lady. And well, it still astounds me that Sound of Music was the biggest selling album of the 60s.
Yeah.
You know, it just shows the power of the older pocket. You know,
well, there's so many soundtrack albums in the charts all throughout the 60s because, of course, there was no such thing as video. You couldn't watch the film again.
Yeah.
You'd go and see it at the cinema. Think, oh, I want to hear that. You know, and people would always go to the cinema. You'd have this. Anyway, it's like those Monty Python albums. I used to have those because you couldn't, there's no other way of
seeing
the film.
You'd learn those by rote and say them at school all the time. The contractual obligation album was like, I knew every word of that. You know, we used to sit in class going, I like traffic lights. Oh, yeah. until the teacher threw us out, you know.
Yeah, what I was saying earlier about all these bands doing the same sort of songs, I think it's probably the most successful because the Animals do it as well. They're doing, Story of Bo Diddley, they do on their... album, which is quite a remarkable it's their debut album, and they start it with a song that's nearly 6 minutes long. Yeah. And it's I don't know if I like it or not, but it's interesting. It's Eric Burdon, and he's sort of singing about other artists as well. So he mentions Bo Diddley and Bob Dylan and Bobby V, the Beatles, and then each time he mentions them, he'll sing a verse of one of their songs.
All right.
A bit like Stars on 45 kind of thing. But to a Bo Diddley beat.
1 year later, in a place called Liverpool in England, the four young guys with mop haircuts began to sing stuff like, it's been a hard day's night, and I've been working like a dog, and so on.
But he would later do that when he did Monterey in 67.
The Who exploded into fire and light. You Massengillers' music was black as night. The grateful day,
the women. Is it the Who? played with Electric Fire, and then do a little Who guitar solo.
Yeah, they stayed very true to their R&B roots, the Animals, didn't they? And right from the start, you know, House of the Rising Sun was a very long 45, you know, for the time, 3.5 minutes. And, you know, it was like something else. You know, it was the Hey Jude of its day, I suppose.
Yeah.
But the rest of their albums, they didn't have any hits on any of their albums. It was all sort of like R&B and sort of driving stuff, Animalisms, Animal Tracks. All those are sort of really earthy albums. They didn't sort of go pop, whatever, didn't do a Kinks even, you know, so didn't have any really big hits when they moved to Decca. And so
and a lot of change lineups as well.
Of course. Chas Chandler was a bit older, I think, than everybody else, so
he did okay for himself, though.
he did struck gold. I noticed it was one of his birthdays in that date diary thing, and he was like 26 or 27 in 1964, so he was old, you know?
Yeah, old timer. Highlight for me is number 10, Five Faces of Manfred Mann, which of all the bands we've really been talking about, I think these are the most successful in doing covers. I mean, the version of Howling Wolf's Smokestack Lightning is phenomenal.
The opening track.
It's just one chord and one riff, but the dramatization and instrumentation, the dynamic.
They were great musicians, and they came from like a jazz background. They could really play their stuff, and it's a really good sound quality album as well. I've got a copy here. It's been really well played. And Sakawo, and, you know, up against all the other recordings of that time, they are recorded really well, and they really do stand out. And this is a mono album only, and it really has a presence to it. I got my mojo working, and they're all that.
But as you say, Sakawo, because it's basically a 12-bar blues, which can be quite boring. But the instrumentation, you've got Paul Jones' harmonica, Mike Vickers' saxophone solo, and then Manfred's piano, and then Mike Hugg's vibes. So it's all these different, sort of like Brian Jones did with the Stones, just brings that bit of colour.
Yeah, yeah, they were all musicians. I mean, they were very skilled musicians as well. So, you know, it really came through. And what they did later on, I mean, they did 5-4-3-2-1, which is like a bit of a million miles away from stuff on this album. But it was the album everybody had. And I read Nick Drake even had this album too. It was one of his favourites when he went to university. It's one of the albums he took with him because he loved all these sort of early R&B too. But
you don't really hear that in his music.
No, you don't. That's what surprised me too. And it stuck in my... And you never find a good copy of this. It's always beaten up like this because they were played and really enjoyed. And I love seeing, you know, records like this, although it's not good if you're going to sell them, but a record that's been loved and played and is much better than a pristine mint copy, which has just been bought and put in the cupboard.
Yeah.
You know, it just has a life. And I love records like that. It hasn't got a name on it, actually, but it's been well parted, I think, but still sounds great because it's a great recording.
Yeah. I think my favourite on that's Bring It to Jerome, which is a song by Jerome Green, but somehow even though it's about him, they've made it their own. It's just one of the best things they ever did, I think. I love it.
Bring it to Jerome.
Tell me, baby, bring it to Jerome. What you're trying to do.
Bring it to Jerome.
You know better, mama.
Bring it to Jerome.
I'm so crazy about you.
Bring it to Jerome.
I'm so crazy about you.
Bring it to Jerome.
I'm so crazy about you.
Definitely worth a listen. Definitely worth a listen again. Great album. Cool cover too. Such a cool cover.
Oh, yeah.
Amazing.
One thing I would definitely suggest, Five Live Yardbirds, which I think is one of the best live albums of all time. It's just incredible. And you can hear Led Zeppelin, even though it's Clapton on guitar. And they used to call it rave-ups, didn't they, where they just go into these long instrumental breaks. All the dynamics really tight. And, Smokestack Lightning they do as well. Too Much Monkey Business.
I mean, these great groups who never sold huge amounts of records, there was live that must have been fantastic. You know, Yardbirds and and all those sort of R&B groups that never met, you know, Graham Bond and all these sort of must have been fantastic live acts that didn't transfer onto albums, you know, even though if everybody had bought one of the records they'd seen that night, you know, it still wouldn't have made it into the charts. They weren't chart material, but live. And yeah, the Yardbirds, five live Yardbirds, is just one of those crossovers where it did really make it. And yeah, no, I agree totally.
One day we rode the mountain crest, and I went east and he went west. I took to law and wore a star, while he spread terror near and far. With lead and blood he gained such fame, all through the west they feared the name of Ringo. Ringo,
Ringo. So meanwhile, what was going on in the US? So number one, we have Lorne Greene with Ringo.
Yeah, Ringo. Yeah, you'd think it would be about Ringo. Well, it probably, a lot of people who bought it probably thought it was going to be about Ringo because it had Ringo in the title and he was the most popular Beatle at that time over in America. But it was basically a spoken word country and western song about a cowboy outlaw called Ringo.
Yeah.
Nothing to do with Ringo Starr at all. Although there were other songs, records that were released at that time which were about Ringo. There's one called The Other Ringo by Larry Finnegan. And there's also one called Ringo's Revenge by someone called Robin Garrett. I don't know that song, but it was tied to the Beatles, I guess, to make up for the disappointment for the people who bought Lorne Greene, and it wasn't about the Beatles.
It's a whole market we could exploit.
Yeah. So, yeah, I guess he could have put any song out with Ringo in the title and it probably would have got to number one.
Yeah.
You know, it just happened to be Lorne Greene who got there first.
Well, no one told me about her. Way she lied. Well, no one told me about how many people cried. But it's too late to say you're sorry. How would I know? Why should I care? Please don't bother trying to find her. She's not there. Well, let me tell you about the way she looked.
Got all sorts of Bobby Vincent, leader of the gang, Zombies, She's Not There, number four.
Yeah, so. It charted higher in the States than it did in the UK, only got to number 12 in the UK. And it's a big mix at this time. I mean, Bobby Vinton, Mr. Lonely, didn't chart in the UK at all, but it was number two in the States. And you get a lot of this sort of thing going on at this time. Shangri-La's Leader of the Pack, same thing to do with Terry, and the Leader of the Laundromat by the Detergents, which eventually peaked to number 18. Then you got the Stones at number six with Time Is On My Side, which wasn't a single. In Britain, they had Little Red Rooster, and America had Time Is On My Side.
And I wonder why that was. Why, obviously, Time is a pop song, isn't it?
It was also on their album, Rolling Stones Now, I think, as well, and they released it from the album. And they followed it up with Heart of Stone, which wasn't a single in the UK either.
Yeah.
So all weirdness was
different
going
markets,
on.
I guess.
Yeah. But you had You Really Got Me at number seven. Early Kinks success.
Come See About Me at eight. Great song. Supremes are everywhere, aren't they?
Yeah. Also got Beach Boys again, Dance, Dance, Dance. And the B-side of Elvis's Ain't Loving You Baby, Ask Me at number 12, because B-sides charted as well as A-sides in the States because of the radio play.
We've also got a new entry at 22, I Feel Fine by the Beatles.
Yeah, and She's a Woman at number 46. Both charted. That was something that took my head a long time to get around. A single could chart twice in the States, and that never happened in Britain, even with double A sides there. You know? They just picked one side and went with it. Women's Hermits, I'm Into Something Good, the big US breakthrough for them. And Manfred Mann also at number 19. So there was a big sort of presence of coming through of British acts now, obviously on the back of the Beatles. Women's Hermits, the Kinks were there, and Manfred Mann were there. So, yeah. They were coming through. The Zombies, of course, got the highest, and that was the end of them for the next seven or 8 years until Time of the Season.
By which time they'd already split up.
Exactly. It's a funny old world, isn't it?
It is. US albums chart. Number one, we have the Beach Boys in Concert.
Yeah, very, very strange album.
Well, this was similar to the Hollywood Bowl by the Beatles, which eventually came out as two separate recordings. One was from 63 and one was 64. But I find it amazing what you're saying about the Beach Boys chart. This is their only number one US album in the 60s. And the only other number one album they had was the The Endless Summer compilation in the 70s. I just find it bizarre. Obviously, they were more popular over here, especially around Pet Sounds. But
it's also strange that having that at number one, the Beatles didn't think we should make an in-concert too, and they could have an album too, but that never happened.
But wasn't the Hollywood Bowl was kind of that? That was the intention, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah, that's right. That would have been... Yeah, that would have already been done. Mid-65, that would have been done already. But yeah, I guess they didn't. There wasn't so much noise at the Beach Boys concert than there was at the Beatles concert.
But yeah, it's got some great tracks on it. It's got Fun, Fun, Fun. They kept the live vocals, but they used the studio version for the backing.
All right.
And had to speed it up slightly to match the vocals. So there's a bit of trickery going on. But a lot of it's Mike Love gooning around with Monster Mash and Papa Hum Mama, Papa Hum, that one.
Yeah, it had to be there sort of thing, you know?
Yeah.
I've got it, but I haven't listened to it for a long time, gosh.
Yeah, one I would definitely recommend is Graduation Day, which there's some humour going on with the crowd, but the harmonies are just breathtaking, really good. That's a standout for me.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of... Some Beach Boys albums weren't released till many years after in Britain. I think Surfer Girl wasn't released until 1967 in Britain. It took years for them to come out. There was a real sort of mismatch of releases. I mean, people talk about the Beatles being messed up, but it was the other way around. It was the Beach Boys albums in Britain came out like a year later. I think Today came out a year later than they did in the States and only came out in mono. Of course, there wasn't a stereo version and all that sort of business going on. So, yeah, it must have been quite confusing to be a Beach Boys fan back then. But as I say in my videos, people in America didn't know what was happening in Britain, and people in Britain didn't really know what was happening in America. So although we think of it now as being a complete mess, at the time, nobody knew and nobody cared. There we go.
Yeah.
I found it too.
Oh, you got it.
It's a stereo copy, actually. It's unusual.
Very nice.
Yeah, February 65, it came out in Britain.
I Get Around is basically the studio version with some screaming thrown on.
Let's Go Tripping. In My Room, Graduation Day. Johnny Be Good ends on Johnny Be Good. Yeah, cool. Keep all the pressure. Keep all the pressure. I've got to keep on pushing. I can't stop now. Move up a little higher. Some way or somehow, 'cause I've got my strength and it don't make sense not to keep on pushing. US albums, it's very different from the British albums. You mentioned The Impressions, number 17, Keep On Pushing.
Yes, one of my favourite albums.
Beginning to break into the mainstream with his socially conscious soul.
Yeah, it's just a fantastic album. The first song, Keep On Pushing, sounds like it could be from the 70s. And obviously, it's early civil rights support, which would obviously people get ready, they'd come up with, which is probably my favourite song of all time, the following year. But it's and even the cover, so I think it was Curtis Mayfield's car, a Jaguar. It was trying to put the point that, you know, I'm a black man in the 60s and I've got a Jaguar, but it's taking three of us to push it. You know, we've achieved that much, but we haven't achieved enough at all, you know, so we've got to keep on pushing. But it's great, and they do a thing, Amen, which is lovely, which I think Bob Marley did later. It's just a lovely album that I reckon not a lot of people have heard, and I reckon just go and get it. The Impressions, keep on pushing.
Well, if it's got a nice car on the cover, I'm loving to look at it. So. I'm a sucker for any album with a car on the cover like that. There's not so much. I mean, the British charts are full of R&B albums. There's really nothing R&B on this American chart at all. Oh. It's very old school. You know, you've got Andy Williams and you've got Louis Armstrong and people like that. But then you've got Elvis, Roustabout, Hard Day's Night, and Something New, also on there together.
Mm.
Nancy Wilson, I guess she's jazz pop crossover. So yeah, completely different to the British charts. There's a British invasion, but no R&B. That seems to be in completely British fashion at the time.
It's strange, isn't it?
I guess they'd been through all that and they'd done the R&B thing and it was passé then.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, but
To British kids, it was sort of new. You know, they hadn't had it. You know, bit of Motown, but that leads on to the R&B things. But although the Supremes have "Where Did Our Love Go" at number 8, expected there to be more sort of Motown stuff in here, really, but I guess they weren't an album.
Still quite early, label. Yeah, December 64, yeah, and it was more singles. Wasn't it?
Wonderful Egg Pod Express.
It's Maureen O'Grady, her pseudonym. This is Dodo's Datebook.
Dark and dreary December, don't believe it. There's lots of interesting and exciting dates in my book this month.
But yeah, it's like a little calendar of what's happening this month.
All the package tours and all the gigs that were going on. You know, everybody who was anybody was on a package tour. It's amazing you could see so many stars in one concert. And they were still playing the cinemas and whatever, the Odeons and the Gaumonts and that sort of stuff. And they must have been incredible things to go to, especially today where you see everything in a huge stadium. You could go and see 5 or 6 big stars in one night, you know, sort of at your local cinema. The Foremost, The Hollies, Danny Williams, Cliff Bennett, Tommy Quickley, and the Beatles' Christmas show with Freddie and the Dreamers. So, yeah, incredible things. Something every day of the week in December.
Just the lineups as well. So at the Wigan ABC, you've got Jerry and the Pacemakers, Gene Pitney, The Kinks, and Marianne Faithfull on one package tour. It's incredible. At the Doncaster Beaumont, Dusty Springfield, Brian Paul and the Tremonos, Dave Berry and Herman's Hermits, and then Heinz, Brenda Lee and Manfred Mann. Strange, that's quite a strange one. Sheffield City Hall. But strange how that thing died out. I guess it's kind of comes back now on the nostalgia tours that we get.
Yeah, that's what they've been doing since then. Yeah, that's what they used to. They do 20 minutes, next person comes on, does another 20 minutes, does the hits, and that's it. It was only a problem for people who were, you know, before the Beatles. They would get shouted off and booed off and whatever. But from what I've read and what I've heard, you know, everyone was remarkably pally and friendly and everyone got on and had good memories of these things.
Mm. Although later on we're going to do an article about Heinz, which he didn't quite have a good one.
It's a shame none of these were recorded or filmed so much, you know. All we have left are the posters and the programs, but nobody really thought to film a lot of these things.
Be sure of lasting personal freshness all day. Be sure of lasting freshness all evening too. Be sure with Body Mist, the perfumed spray deodorant. With Body Mist, you're really sure of personal freshness and sure of a lovely lingering perfume. Be really sure with Body Mist Spray, the perfumed deodorant.
And also this month, we've got some birthdays to celebrate. We've got Matt Monroe, Tom McGinnis from the Manfreds, he's 23, Brenda Lee's 20, Dionne Warwick is 23, Dave Clark, 22, Keith Richards, just 20 years old, Chaz Chandler, 24, Del Shannon, 25, and the veteran singer Bo Diddley, who's reached the ripe old age of 36.
I know, yeah. You forget how young everybody was back then doing these things. You talk about the 60s, I talk about the 60s all the time, and remember, yeah, all these people were in their mid-20s, and I was in my mid-20s a long time ago. And when I was in my mid-20s, I wasn't doing stuff like this,
no.
You know. So it's like, well, you know. So, yeah, everybody just so young. And the Beatles themselves as well, you know.
Yeah. Page 45, we've got some adverts. We've got HMV Oxford Street, Hardy Amy's ABC of Men's Fashion, Get With It identity bracelets and medallions. And there's a book for sale.
Yeah. There it is. I have my copy here. I'm sure you're going to reach for yours too. Mine's falling apart. Is yours falling apart? It's got all the glue has gone in the spine and it's all falling apart. Oh, you've got yours in a nice plastic wallet. I haven't got mine. I've just got mine here falling apart.
Just get somebody's out of my wallet.
Somebody's practiced John Lennon's signature on the front of mine. But
oh, bless.
But yeah, great book. I mean, one of the best early books about the Beatles by Michael Braun, who followed them late 63, early 64. And, you know, it's pretty much ignored at the time by the magazine. I mean, it's an advert here, but it was the Beatles Monthly didn't mention it. I guess it was thought as being a bit of an image killer, maybe, because there's a lot of stuff in here which is quite truthful. But didn't it get reissued a few years ago too, I think?
But it's an incredible, it's the best. I think Mark Lewisohn, I think he said this before he did his own book, but he said it's the one must-have Beatles book. It's there at the time, isn't it? They were there. You know what Beatles stuff like is now. It just goes through a committee for a legacy. Yeah. And this certainly isn't.
Yeah, I mean, and completely the opposite of what this magazine was about. You know, this magazine was a bit very, you know, light and tittle-tattle, but that was quite serious journalism, which was really refreshing at the time. But here it is for 4 shillings and 6 pence from all booksellers and newsagents. Over 250,000 sold in America, it says.
Wow.
Page 52, we have a funny thing happened on the way to the top. A funny thing happened on the way to the, it's an old joke, as old as the music hall itself, but it's still true today. There's hardly one group in the bestsellers that hasn't had a funny thing happen to them, as Dick Tatham discovered. And yeah, that's what it says on the tin list, doesn't it?
Yeah, just various stories. Anecdotes. Like from the Yardbirds about being chased by disappointed male fans and pretty things with Viv. You know, Viv Prince again, sort of being called chaotic and all this sort of stuff. Not all of them made it to the top. I suppose the Poets didn't make it to the top.
No. Bass guitarist John Dawson from the Poets. After a one-nighter in Bury, we headed for London. We ran into a pea soup of fog. We drove round and round in bottom gear from midnight till 5 in the morning. Didn't as much as find anywhere we could get a cuppa. I won't repeat what we said in those 5 hours, but it definitely wasn't poetry. But yeah, nothing happened.
All about touring, you know, in those buses, those old beat-up comma vans and stuff, and just going around the country, going to Germany, the Rocking Berries, the Nashville Teens, you know.
Yeah.
And good grief, Viv Prince muttered to himself, not them again. I glanced through the music publisher's window and realised it was them right enough and they were just passing by. So, yeah, it was, I think somebody has to make a film about Viv Prince.
Oh, please, Sam Mendes, stop what you're doing and make the Viv Prince movie instead.
Shall we talk about the Beatles films?
If you want.
There's some pictures
I'd rather watch... Have you ever seen Dewey Cox, the comedy where they do the Beatles spoof? He's this fake American pop star
from
the 60s. And basically everything that happens, he's the forefront. He starts the Beatles, he starts the blues and all this kind of thing. And he does this scene where he's with these, and they're American actors. He's got Jack Black playing Paul McCartney, and they're the worst Liverpudlian accents, but deliberately so.
Only through meditation can we begin to understand our role.
We're nothing but grains of sand.
That was freaking transcendental, Paul McCartney. Don't you agree, John Lennon?
Yes, Dewey Cox. With meditation, there's no limit to what we can imagine.
What do you think, George Harrison, of the Beatles?
I don't know, you know, I'm just trying to get some more songs on the album, you know.
And as Ringo Starr, I'm not so interested in meditation. I just like to have fun.
I like the little one.
It's so dark in this tent, you know. It reminds me when we, the Beatles, the four Beatles, us.
From Liverpool.
Yes, we are from Liverpool. Liverpool.
We used to play those dark clubs in Hamburg. Remember that, Paul?
Of course I do. I booked them. I'm the leader of the Beatles.
The best Beatles films have been comedies anyway, haven't they? So,
oh, yeah.
They should, Rattles, they should make it as a comedy, you know. It's like, oh,
yeah. But, yeah, are you looking forward to it?
No, I'm not. Well, it'll be something to talk about on a video, I suppose. If it comes, what's it, April 28th, it's coming out, I think. They are coming out. There'll be plenty to talk about, absolutely. You know, how they use the wrong microphones, how they use the wrong record player, the labels are not the right colour, all that sort of stuff.
Well, I was approached by the filmmakers, one of their researchers, when I was still doing I Am the Eggpod. And I forget, they were asking me for a contact. Most of my emails I got were from some, you know, big organization. And I get all excited and say, oh, have you got the phone number for one of your guests? But it was a similar sort of thing. And I said, just a thing, I hope you speak to Julia Baird about John's life, because she knows so much about it, you know, and she'll correct a lot of information stuff. And this researcher came back and said, well, I don't think he's got any sisters. Oh, no. Okay. Well, good luck.
I know. I really don't look forward to these things. Even now that the things are coming out now, you become aware that you probably know more than they do, or the people who are putting this thing together, done by committee or whatever. And, you know, obviously there are people who know their stuff there, but I get embarrassed sometimes, the little mistakes they make and on the issues and on the stuff. And you expect, I mean, I make mistakes all the time because I'm one person sitting in here doing this by myself for a huge multinational team or whatever to get the wrong thing out and whatever. Just heard this thing about the Style Council release. Did you hear about that? They've just reissued the Café Bleu.
Oh, yeah.
And they've had to recall everything because they used the wrong mixes or something and whatever. And the whole thing has been down the toilet because somebody didn't listen to it properly and used the right mix.
Is it still coming out?
It is, but, you know, I think it's coming out today, I think end of January, and instructions to return it because you're going to get a new one later or something like that. So, you know, and sometimes you think, well, why don't they ask the sort of fans about these things? I mean, you do get fans involved like Bruce Spizer and whatever, but sometimes they should sort of cast the net a bit wider and sort of just ask, you know, did this happen or was this, what label was this on? And they rely just on a few people in their sort of family, close family to sort of come up with this stuff. And they do make mistakes and, you know, you think they shouldn't make mistakes.
Okay. We turn to page 54. Who knew? It's an interview with Sandy Shaw's mum.
It must be so embarrassing. Let your mum do an interview. You imagine let my mother do an interview about my videos or something. It's like, no. What's she going to say? Be embarrassed by that.
But her mum talks about the bare feet. Her mum says, some people think it's a bit of a gimmick, but she's always had this thing about going barefoot. As soon as she comes in, she throws off her shoes. She never wears house slippers, just wanders around barefoot. A few weeks ago, Sandy was a bridesmaid at her cousin's wedding. My husband and I were sitting in the church, just a little way back from where Sandy was standing with the other bridesmaids. Suddenly, I turned to my husband. I'm seeing things, aren't I? I asked him. But it was true. Sandy had slipped off her shoes. She hasn't worn these white shoes since. It's funny. She has this thing about white accessories. Just can't stand them. Just sounds like any teenager ever, really, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I think she was very, you know, she was from Dagenham in Essex. She was very down to earth at that time. You know, she just made it. And nobody else has done the barefoot thing since. So she's got that thing sewn up completely. But, you know, she was, there's a picture here with Adam Faith and Chris Andrews. I mean, she was so lucky to hook up with him, who was a talented guy. And, as you said, she put out some belters toward the end of the 60s.
Oh, yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And still around, thankfully.
Yes. Sandy, if you're listening, come on this podcast.
Spill the beans. All those great stories that you times from rave. But I'm just in this. I watched a film the other day, Letter to Brezhnev, again, it's on BBC iPlayer.
Oh, yeah.
And she sings, well, there's always something there to remind me in that film. So it really got in my head this week. But great film, haven't you?
Check out the Dionne Warwick version. Love
it. Yes, sir. Yes, will do.
And at the bottom of this, we have an advert. It's Fab. Emmy Tapes Pop Party. 40 minutes of top pops for only 16 shillings.
Yeah, basically a budget EMI sampler tape for all the kids that were getting into reel-to-reel. And there were a lot. I mean, the reel-to-reel market was huge it started off, obviously, as a hi-fi thing for hi-fi bus for your dad. But by 64, like, my father had a sort of small Stellaphone reel-to-reel player that you record things off the radio, and you could buy reel-to-reel tapes of albums in the shops. They didn't sound particularly good, but you got a little box with a picture of the album on, and they were quite popular for the time, like cassettes became later on. And this one is a sampler with the Beatles' All My Loving on it, which is, I think, the only time they ever allowed their music on a compilation, definitely on a budget compilation anyway, until much later on. And all the other EMI stars of the time, Baron Knight's Call Up the Groups, which is a great song, Aka Bilk, maybe not, Russ Conway, Georgie Fame, Frank Ifield, Pepe Yaramillo, and Cliff in the Shadows, of course, Manfred Mann too. So, yeah. And you could send off a rapper off the Emmy tape, blank Emmy tape, and send 16 shillings and 1 and 6 for package and posting. And they would send you this pop party tape as long as you did it by the 31st of January, 1965. I had one of these once. I've seen one of them once. I've had one in the collection. I sold it many, many years ago. Just an artifact, really. The quality of the music, the quality of the sound isn't very good, but it's quite a rare thing now. So if you've got one, I think, you know, £50-60, I should think, for that.
Really? Wow. There's no other compilations. I can't think of any compilations with a Beatles song.
No, I think there was some in the early 80s on MFP, and they did do some. I won't mention the name of the album, Savile's Travels, on MFP. They did have, I've seen I Wanna Hold Your Hand and someone on that.
He did a series of
yearly things.
I remember, yeah.
Under that thing. And there was some Beatles ones on that. But that was sort of 1980, just when the MFP things started going cheap anyway.
Yeah. See, that's another thing that person's ruined is my childhood. He used to do a radio show, the old Record Club.
Yeah, I love that too. He'd be out on a marathon or something, wouldn't he? And he'd be sort of like saying, I'm running on this marathon, and he sort of give you points if you recognize the title or you recognize the brackets around the title or something.
Yeah.
And
I hated him at the time, but it was just the music. I wanted to hear all that great. And I think it was like Pick of the Pops, isn't it? I'm sure they pick a year. I can't remember, but you would hear loads of 60s stuff.
I think it was just sort of random. I think they'd pick a year. Yeah, I don't remember that, but I remember it being on Sunday afternoons or something, wasn't it?
Yeah.
After Family Favourites or something it was on. But yeah, I mean, he's everywhere. I've got these scrapbooks of the 60s and he's everywhere in them. You know, he was at the Sgt. Pepper launch party. He was on the Beatles Christmas shows. He was very integrated in that club, you know, just because he was there. You know, he pushed himself in. But, you know, I mean, we could talk a lot about sort of not nice people that time. People like Chris Denning or whatever, who turned out to be sort of... I mean, I met him again in the late 80s when I was selling things at the auction house, and he phoned up and said, well, I've got some Beatles things, which he did, some signed Beatles things. And I went over to his house, quite a brave thing to do on my own. I was only like 20 or something. And I went into his house and there was this sallow youth sat on his sofa, you know, sort of like... pale looking, you know, young guy, and in his garage he had all his record collection sort of like everywhere, and he had the Stones promotional album, he had all this rare stuff, and did sell some signed things for him, which did quite well. But later when I was living in Prague, he was living in Prague too, and got into all sorts of mischief and stuff, and it was quite sad because he had a lot of interesting stuff and he was in that inner circle. So
it's just so sad that whole part of history tarnished in that way. It's it is what it is, I guess.
Yeah, I know, yeah. It's sad.
Page 56, The Night I Nearly Wept. Heinz tells of the night that haunts him, a night when it seemed his bid for stardom had been suddenly and hopelessly wrecked. We've got Heinz Burt interview.
Yeah, Heinz, one of Joe Meek's protégés, Yeah, it's a story about how he got dropped off late to a gig where he was on the support for Gene Vincent and Jerry Lee Lewis, and he got booed off stage, basically, because they all wanted to see Jerry Lee Lewis and Gene Vincent. And then how he bounced back a few weeks later when Just Like Eddie, his big hit, became, got high in the charts, and he was welcomed back and all the audience were cheering at him instead of throwing things at him like they were before. So yeah. A little happy ending to that article, but his life, his career didn't really end that happily, unfortunately. So yeah.
No.
That was it.
Well, it mentions in here, Heinz, you'll have to go like mad, my manager Joe Meek had told me a few days before. You stop filming Live It Up at 5 and you must be in Birmingham Town Hall by 7:15.
Yeah.
And Live It, have you ever seen Live It Up?
Yeah, I think I have, yeah.
Oh, dear. It's one of... I think if anybody's not seen it, it's a film with David Hemmings. Yeah. And it's about a band called the Smart Alex. And also in the film, you've got Steve Marriott, who's playing the drummer. And it's just the creepiest thing. If you check out the footage for a song called Don't You Understand from Live It Up, is that the creepiest thing you'll ever see. Is just terrifying.
He was a bit of a creepy-looking guy. He was, you know, he was the sort of sad face guy. There's a guy, a German guy, who looks similar to him called Heimo, I think. And he looked like Heinz, but he wore really dark glasses. And he had this shocking blonde hair. And I see his records lying around at flea markets, and it's quite shocking. Some of these 60s film stars, 60s pop stars in Germany. Heimo, it was like blind version of Heinz, I thought. So,
I mean, I've been listening to some Heinz. I've never really listened to him before, but obviously Just Like Eddie and all that. But it's quite interesting. Obviously, it's soaked in Joe Meek production. But Joe Meek obviously obsessed over him. He absolutely loved him, but it was unrequited because Heinz wasn't gay. And it was Joe who put him in the Tornadoes, obviously had a huge number one. But a lot of the songs, you can hear Joe Meek's lyrics obsessing, you know, it's all about obsessive love and I want what I can't have and this kind of thing. Well, I'm sure Heinz knew about the obsession, but I don't know if the lyrics would have meant anything. Joe got Heinz to actually move in his flat in the end, and
wow.
Which would is probably the worst thing for Joe, because he would have just eaten his obsession even more. Because Heinz used to go shooting, and it was his gun that Joe used to do the deed, unfortunately. Oh. But it's a sad ending for him as well.
Don't think anybody came out of the Joe Meek stable with any sort of happy ending. You know, it was all very tragic. And when you hear a Joe Meek song, it's always a sort of like, it's very atmospheric, but it's like has a sadness about it, and that appeals to a lot of people. But it's a great story, and I know they made films and stuff, but I like a lot of his stuff from that point of view. Can you imagine if it like produced Scott Walker or something? That would have been great.
Oh wow.
Joe Meek producing Scott Walker,
that would be incredible. Wow. And final fact, Just Like Eddie features Richie Blackmore from Deep Purple on guitar. Mm-hmm. There you go.
And the Outlaws as well, though.
Page 57, we have a full page ad. Two fab offers from Taifu Tea.
Yeah, you only get a new with Taifu. But yeah, Taifu did everything. They used to do little cards and things, and they were well up with their promotional stuff. And here you could have free framed pop stars, colour print of any of these 12 pop stars in a beautiful heart-shaped frame, free from Taifu. Just collect numbers 1 to 12 of the heart-shaped symbols on Taifu tea packets and send them up onto Taifu. It's as easy as that. And who did you get? Your Tommy Quickly, Joe Brown, Kenny Ball, Chris Curtis, John McAnally, Mike, all the searchers. Yeah, sort of.
VJ.
Couldn't afford the Beatles.
No.
Searches. Dave Clark, Jerry Marsden, Adam Faith, Billy Joe.
It's not the top of the... There's no Stones.
It's the B-list, isn't it? C-list, even. And win a top six disc, one of these cover version EPs that you could get as well.
There's so many of these random... I mean, you'll know, hopefully, about this. all these random promotional-only discs from the 60s? Because there was a lot of these, if you buy this, send off a coupon, yeah, get this, like the Emmy tape kind of things.
Yeah, it could do all sorts of things. I think Country Life Butter and all this sort of stuff did them. CBS Special Products did them as well. I've had some in boxes of random singles. I think things to do with butter and jam and things, and you would get singles. And I think CBS were quite big at it. CBS Special Products, also things you can get, like Mary Poppins and all this sort of easy listening stuff as well, basically. But they were sort of around a lot. They came in little special envelopes and things. I've got some. Again, another video idea, but there you go.
I reckon you'd get about 50 episodes out of this issue.
Yeah. 50 views as well.
Yeah, might all be me.
Now I think of an angle. Think of a title. That's the main thing. Think of a title.
Oh, did you want to do Proby, PJ Proby?
Not really. No, just to sort of say what a bit of a loser he was even back then.
Yeah, let's do that then. Yeah. Okay. On page 59, bad boy Proby confesses. Anything to say about PJ Proby, Andrew?
Yeah, well, apparently according to this story, he got divorced in America and was a big loser over there. So he came to Britain to sort of reinvent himself as a, I don't know what, basically sort of says why I'm afraid of girls. Girls scare him in this article. I can understand why, really, with that haircut for a start. And I mean, he had a good career. I mean, he made some popular singles and of course did cover the Beatles' That Means a Lot, which, although it wasn't a hit, is still how he's remained in the Beatles' public eye at the moment. And he did sort of very operatic versions of Somewhere and you know, very over the top sort of voice. Not my cup of tea, really, but you know, they sold.
Yeah, moving on.
And he says in the back, you know, sort of like, my hair looks like a darn woman's, so I have to go to a woman's hairdresser, Vidal Sassoon. And he says Sandy Shaw, extremely good, but she sounds like Dionne Warwick.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's still around, but a character, shall we say.
Yeah, that's one word for begins with C I'd use.
You know more about him than I do.
Oh, just, yeah, Google.
Right.
And then we've got a couple of posters. We've got the Hollies, looking very youthful.
Yeah, lovely pictures of the Hollies, yeah.
Yeah, and then Wayne Fontana. Obviously, Eric Stewart there, looking about 12 years old. Future 10cc.
That's right, yeah.
Top right. And then the animals. I love that photo.
Yeah.
Peeking little heads.
Classic sort of 60s photo thing. I think the Hollies did something like that with Torn Paper on their first album, sort of like in amongst bits of torn paper and things. That was a classic 60s, early 60s setup by photographers, wasn't it? Yeah, what should we do?
Eric Burdon looks exactly like Alfred E. Newman from Mad Comic.
That's probably based it on him.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. They all had big albums in the charts at that time, didn't they? The Animals' debut album was just out that month. Wayne Fontana had that one. The Hollies, too, were just getting towards their peak. I love the Hollies. I mean, I really have a soft spot for the Hollies.
Yes. I saw Graham Nash a few months ago. He was superb.
Oh, I did a tour. Yeah, I heard that was good.
With Peter Asher, he did a duet. It's a bit like what Paul does with John's voice on I've Got a Feeling. He had an old recording of Gordon singing True Love Ways.
All right.
He duetted with his old record. Oh, it was so beautiful. Lovely. Yeah. But yeah.
Yeah, Graham Nash is
Graham Nash's voice is still...
They're all still going, I think, the Hollies. I think they're all still around. The drummer and Eric Haydock is no longer with us, but the rest of them are. You know, I've heard Alan Clark is still singing. He did lots of interviews a while ago as well, and they're still best mates as well, I think. But yeah, I've done one video on the Hollies and want to do more.
Yes, do.
But yeah, I mean, they made some great albums in the 60s. Just suffered from a sort of a poor producer, basically. If they'd have had George Martin instead of Ron Richards, they would have.
Yeah. So, Andrew, listeners, don't worry, I'm going to edit this, but for Andrew and myself, this is a 4-hour.
I just had my lunch when I started.
It's time for breakfast soon. I appreciate your time, but I hope you've enjoyed it. I have spent hours talking about
Well, yeah, it's not often I get the chance to sort of talk in depth about these things to anybody but myself and this microphone. microphone or a camera. So yeah, it's been a real pleasure to talk to you on this thing. But I hope everybody else enjoys it and gets something from it. I hope we said something entertaining, and I've really enjoyed being on here, and I hope one day we can do it again.
Absolutely. So thanks to Susie Humphrey for the jingles. And to read this issue of Rave, the magazine's online at iamtheeggpot.com, where you'll also find an exclusive playlist of this week's top 30 singles. To support this podcast and to access bonus content, please subscribe to patreon.com/eggpod. But for now, thanks so much, Andrew Milton. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.